contrast how poor, you know, the low quality of the courtiers in the palace, because the lazy boy could rise up, you know, and suddenly become a court a servant. So he had a very fast career rise. And then why did the poor boy fart? Because I think he wanted to question the necessity of food serving, you know, food service. Because can a king take food himself? Do he really need to be served a food, as simple as food? And then the science of, you know, farting, what is wrong with farting? The science of gastronomy and the palace norm, you know, there's mismatch. Because you eat food and then if you have some digestion problem, then it's natural to fart. But then you have a palace norm, you know, like forbidding someone from farting, something like that, you know. And then the king resort to a universal punishment, like it's everywhere, you know. Once you do some wrong things, then what you do is that the predictable punishment is the imprisonment. No, then the story contrasts the foolish courtiers and the clever lazy boy. And the courtiers, by conventional norm or conventional understanding, they are supposed to be very clever. But here, the lazy boy, he outsmarts all of them. And then the clever boy tells the guard that it's very foolish on the part to imprison a very clever serpent and then be surrounded himself by foolish courtiers. And the king thinks that, and then king calls this lazy boy, and what can you show how how clever you are? And the lazy boy just informs the king that, you know, if you can find a person who has never farted in their life, I can make a lot of muti, a sort of a blue pearls, you know, precious items, precious stone. And then for the economic greed, you know, the king suddenly sends his courtiers in production to find one subject who has never farted in his life. And the palace courtiers goes everywhere, and then they finally return, and they could not find anyone who has never farted in their entire life. So then the lazy boy tells the king, that means the king must be the only one. So, you know, you be my friend and let's make a muti. And the king becomes so afraid. He was so afraid that, you know, that his stupidity could be exposed in front of everybody. So he releases Then the king acknowledges that, of course, I also fart. It's a natural process, so I must acknowledge. So the lazy boy is released. And then because king felt so embarrassed, embittered, and he really wanted to take revenge, and then he starts with the war of wits. So he assigns the poor boy so many impossible tasks, you know. But then the lazy boy had a proper answer, and then in the process he becomes the king. I think he faces embarrassment after embarrassment. And then here in the story, the story tells the listener is that it's too pity on the king to humble himself to the level of a lazy boy. Like, he should be left like that, you know. Like, I think he really wanted to challenge, I think he should be other person, not this poor lazy boy. So anyway, the lazy boy always win. And then finally the king misuses the course of state power, and then he exiles this king, the lazy boy. And as a consequences, he ends up losing his throne, and then the lazy boy, wins. And then all this discussion, what I'm trying to say is like this discussion about this descent actually is quite similar to the subaltern literature, which is quite vibrant in South Asia, because in South Asia, until now, during the colonialism, the whole history has been written from the prism of the aristocrat, the colonial power, rich, you know, the elites, and whereas the peasants, millions of poor peasants have been ignored. So the subaltern study, they try to actually bring poor people, peasants' contribution to the Mekong history to the forefront. And here, some of the selected folk tales actually provide a clue to how the social relations, the social system had been very unequal and exploitative, you know, especially in the rural areas. And then these stories tell a lot of light on the dominion and control of state power and the authority which were actually the system made by the big people. And then the farmers' resistance to this, this small people's resistance to this use of power, state power. And it is, as I said in the beginning, is the expression of the alternative social order. And social order, not really about the domination. They want the farmers don't want the domination, but they wanted to make it less unjust, less unequal, and less exploitative. And this study of these folk tales actually will help us in understanding the interface between, as explained before, the tension and interface between the big people and these people. And now the national narratives, in the national narratives, you will see the opinions, the viewpoint, the actors or perspective, the content of the state, king, lords, the ascending generation, teacher, man or husband. Whereas the voices of the citizen, the subject, the servant, the descending generation, the people, women or wife, you know, have been neglected. And what I'm trying to, one of my main point here is that by studying those selected folks containing the element of dissent, discontent and rebellion, we can actually write local narratives, you know, parallel to the national narratives containing the voices, the perspectives of the group of people in the blue color, the state voices. You know, we have, you know, in our history, it's all about the history. It, of course, it's being written by people who are in power. So the state, you see a lot of the voice of the state, but then of the citizen, you don't find. Then of the king, but not of the subject. Of the lords, you know, so many in Bhutan we have a lot of we used to have a lot of religious nobilities, but then their servants, their zapa, all those drapa, they were not actually heard. And then of course the if you had the local narratives, sort of a local narrative, it is written from the perspective of the ascending generation, our farmer, you know, and of the voices of the children were not actually heard. And then of the people, always from the teacher's perspective, we have a namthar, a biography of big lamas, but then we don't have of the disciples. Disciples, when they were disciples, of course, as they grow, they also become a lama, but then what about their lives when they were disciples? And then men, the women has been always neglected. Then husband, even at the macro level, then if you can narrow the zoom down, you have now the elder brother, the younger brother. And these are the summary of my presentation. Folk tales reflect social, economic, and political milieu of a particular time and place. And if that is so, it follows, I think, that folk tales originated from some people. This is a big claim I make, and I think, as I said in the beginning, this is a big claim I make. And if you ask me after 2 years, I think I'll have the empirical evidence ready. And there are a lot of elements of dissent and discontent of the small people, our social order made and dominated by big people. This is also, some may say it's a big claim. Well, if you, all you need to do is to pick up one of the Buddhist scriptures available in this translation, and then if you read those scriptures along the hypothesis or the premise I presented, you won't, I think most of the audience won't disagree. And the final point, folktales can be used as a material for writing narratives of small people. So this is my brief presentation. So I welcome.
Very good afternoon, Madam Chair, scholars, dignitaries, teachers, students, and everyone gathered here. Well, it indeed is very inspiring to see so many people gathered here, because it clearly reflects the support and the interest that you show towards this seminar, which has as a theme recognizing and reviving oral traditions. So this is very inspiring. And now, to really go into what I am supposed to do. I would like to begin by recounting a bit about my childhood days. I come from a village, and every winter vacation with my grandparents, I used to go to the pasture land, and I used to listen them tell interesting stories. And it was through their stories that they told me that I could really get a lot of values and many interesting things about the society in which I was born. So, but now, what is actually happening is that we see that this tradition of folktale narration is steadily fading, and it is very appropriate that CBS has come up with this seminar. Even in the school curriculum, as a teacher, I remember teaching Alice in Wonderland and not Bunny's Folk Tales. And as a curriculum officer, I saw and read many, many stories of other countries and very few of Bunny's Folk Tales and Bunny's personal stories. But now, very interestingly, with the curriculum reform, it is heartening to know that the curriculum is now incorporating folktales of Bhutan as well as personal stories written by Buddhist authors. Coming to the media, we storytelling sessions are almost absent. And it would need a lot of effort from all these stakeholders like Ministry of Education, media, research centers, and all the Buddhists to bring back and to revive the storytelling session, which is a very, very important ingredient of Buddhist life. Now, the plan of my presentation, first of all, the title of my paper is Ritualizing Story, A Way to Heal Malady. And the plan of my presentation is, first of all, I would briefly talk about the rules of folk tales, and then I would introduce the ritual and the content of the ritual, read the story, and briefly give a comparative look at the ritual and storytelling, and then conclude and give a concluding remark. Now, first of all, when you talk about the rituals, not rituals, storytelling, the most of us, when you talk about the role of storytelling, we directly relate to entertainment, transmission of knowledge, bridging the generation gap. So these are some of the common things that come to our mind. But this paper of mine would like to go a step ahead and then tell that storytelling is more than entertainment and transmission of knowledge and values, but it is also used as a healing healing process in the villages. And I would demonstrate that and illustrate that through a ritual that I had observed. Now, first of all, let me briefly talk about the rules of storytelling that have been briefly touched upon by the two scholars in the morning. First of all, it is entertainment. As a boy, I'm sure many of us here had the same experiences. For us in the villages, the first purpose of listening to stories was entertainment. Tucked away in the remote villages and devoid of modern entertainment gadgets, one of the entertainments in the villages was storytelling. And even today, if you go to the faraway villages, we still have people telling stories and entertaining their children. So this is one of the reasons. And next one is transmission of knowledge. Coming to the transmission of knowledge, through the stories we learn, we get a lot of knowledge. For example, through the stories, without having gone to Tibet, we know that in the north we have Tibet and in south we have India. Without having seen an ocean, many Buddhists would describe ocean as a large expanse or large body of water, tamejamso, tame, that endless or boundless water. So all these kind of knowledges we get through storytelling. And bridging the generation gap, is another important role of folktale or storytelling. Because now, with globalization and development, we see that the younger generation, they actually do not know many of the things that our parents knew. So slowly, our society actually is cracking down. But a process which can help cement back this gap or bridge the gap between the older and the younger generation is story. For example, when you talk about sacerdotum, that is our fine or mannerism or the fine ways of presenting oneself, and these kind of knowledges we get through folktale or storytelling. For example, we have a story called The Lame Boy, the Poor Boy, and the Lame Monkey. And in this story, it is a lame boy who actually teaches this poor boy how to present himself in a very grand and eloquent manner, how to behave in a very dignified manner. So through this story, what we actually know is that in the Buddhist society, we have fine ways of carrying oneself, and it is through the stories that we do. And it's just one example. And of course, there are many similar themes that talk about the Buddhist values. And these values, actually, through the storytelling, can bridge and bridge the gap between the older and the younger generation. Another important role is building the community and giving identity to the community. For example, through storytelling, in a particular community, in the morning, the two scholars had also touched on that, the way that the story is interpreted by a particular society itself, by itself, is a way of relating themselves or creating an identity for themselves. Now, in the village where I conducted this research, I have seen that they worship a local deity called Radhab. And there is a story that talks about how Radhab, or this local deity, had come to Bhutan, and how this local deity becomes or is worshipped or is elevated to that level from a monk. And his journey to the village called Khodaka in Oniferam region, the story, it is very interesting. And through the story, when Radhab is coming to Khodaka, the man who actually invited him to that village, on the way, lots of conversation and talk happens between the two. And today, the passes along the route taken by this deity and his friend actually are associated to that particular village, because all the mountain passes are related to incidents related to the conversation that took between them. For example, they reach a particular village, and this monk, who later becomes a deity, says that, "I'm feeling sick." And then the man who accompanied him said, "Well, if you are feeling sick, we don't have a name for this place, and we are going to name it Narimu." That means the sick or the ill mountain. And they proceed further, and a little later, this monk again says, "I'm feeling very lethargic." And then this his friend said, "Well, then let us name this Thilela." Thil means to to feel lazy or to feel lethargic. So even today, this mountain is referred to as Thilela. And then the deity, this monk, "Have you reached the place that you had offered me?" And then this man said, "Yes, we have reached here, and this is the place." And then the deity said, "Well, this is a very small mountain peak. Actually, you should say that you are going to offer me a very big mountain." And then this his friend said, "Well, I just told you a lie." And then after that, the mountain came to be called a Shobla. And this is how things actually happen. And even today, the village associate themselves with this kind of stories, and it has become an identity for them. And the way of offering, the Radhab, by that society, they make offerings of prayer flag, and the prayer flag that they offer is a white, a small band of white cloth, and it is without any inscription. And of course, there might be other societies where they make the same offering, but this society the offering of white prayer flag without any inscription is another form of creating, of identifying themselves and having a collective identity for that particular community. So these are some of the examples of how storytelling and folk tales have become a strong vehicle of building the community and the strength of the society. So, and of all, the theme of my paper is storytelling as a ritual to heal malady. And about the healing of malady or illness, there are two ways. One is as a ritual, and one is a real storytelling. This now, I think, is has really gone out of the Buddhist culture. I have not seen that, but as a child, I remember seeing once, observing this once. And this is when someone is sick, a very a man with a very powerful voice would come and sit near the sick person, and he would have a small table, you call chente, small table, in front of him, and an incense stick would be lighted in front of him, and this man would put his cross leg, he would put his left leg over the right, and sit in a very commanding position. And the theme of the story that he tells is the victory of good over evil, or subjugation of evil or malignant spirits. So through the storytelling, in a very commanding and a very powerful way, ultimately what is expected is the sick person is cured or healed. So this is one way. But the one that I'm going to talk about is a real ritual. A story has been put in the form of a ritual, and this ritual is performed to expel a category of malignant spirit called death. And after expelling this malignant category of evil malignant spirit, what actually is expected is that there's prosperity, happiness in the community or in the household. Now, now I'll go on to talk about the ritual. The name of the ritual is called Gelpo Chuni. Gelpo is a category of malignant spirit, and Chuni is expulsion, or expulsion of the malignant spirit called Gelpo. And this ritual is conducted in the village where I had observed, that's Jena, Gyok in Ongifodong. And from my informants, it seems many villages in Ongifodong region, they conduct this ritual. So having introduced the ritual, now I would like to read the story. I'm not a very good very good in narrating folk tales or stories, so I'll just read it for sake of clarity. The story. A very long time ago, in Linkati, the kingdom of King Gesar of Lin, a tree, Chamashin, I do not know the name of this tree, I couldn't manage to find it. The name of the tree is called Chamashin. A tree called Chamashin gave birth to a strange object that appeared like a field sack. People were shocked and worried that it was ominous and might bring calamity to Linkati. However, to the surprise of his subjects, King Gesar of Ling opened the sack and found a baby boy inside. The king decided to bring him up. He was named Changxin Gepo. Changxin, the name is derived from the name of the tree from where this boy was born. King of Changma tree, as he was born from Changma Xin. As the baby turned into a boy, King Gesar of Ling made him the cowboy of his favorite cow called Patenye Kendruzom. The translation of this is, naughty cow where source of all conflict is accumulated. So this is the name of the favorite cow of King Gesar of Ling. Near the cowshed lived a man who cultivated a big wheat field. As the summer wheat turned lush, the man calculated a bountiful harvest. However, to his utter dismay, despite his efforts to protect his field of thriving wheat from animals, every morning he finds that his wheat is eaten by an animal. That summer, he lost all his wheat to an animal that he could not identify, or he did not know. He suspected the cow of King Gesser of Ling, but there was no evidence, and his wheat was incomparable to that of Changxin Gepo, the cowboy. Another season came for cultivating wheat, and the man, like others in the village, did his part. Again, wheat turned green, and despite his effort to protect his wheat field, one morning he found that a small patch of his wheat field was eaten by an animal. He tried to trace the footprints, but could not find one. He kept close guard of the cow of Changxin Gelpo, but to no avail. Who could have eaten the lush wheat? It, of course, was Patenye Kenduzong, the cow of Changxin Gelpo. The cow unlashed itself and went to the wheat field when the man on guard could not help but fall asleep. Just for a while, around the time the first roosters began to give signal of the arrival of dawn, the cow ate its fill and returned to its shed. It was a clever cow, for it left no footprints. It wiped the prints of its foreleg with its hind leg, and that of the hind leg with its tail. The man could tolerate no more, so he kept a trap of poisoned arrow. As usual, the cow came to graze in the wheat field, and it was hit by the poisoned arrow. The cow died in the field. The culprit is caught, and the neighbor demands for compensation. However, Changxin Gelpo demands that the skin of the cow be removed and a small chunk of meat be offered to the guardian deities. The man agreed, and after removing the hide, Changxin Gelpo cuts a small chunk of meat and threw it as offering. Two crows came by, but instead of eating the chunk of meat, they fight. Two dogs came by, and they also fought. Two boys came by, and they fought. The mothers of the two boys joined the fight, the husbands, the local leaders, and ultimately, everyone joined in the fight. Finally, the news of the unrest and the conflict that was happening in his kingdom reached the ears of King Gesser of Ling. The wise king consulted the best astrologer to diagnose the cause of the conflict and the associated prescription. The cause of all the conflict was Changxin Gelpo, who intentionally did not look after the cow. The recommendation was to chase away Changxin Gelpo beyond the frontiers of Lingkati, kingdom of King Gesser of Ling, if peace was to be restored. Thus, a ritual was performed as advised by the astrologer, and Changxin Gelpo was chased away, crossing many rivers and lakes. All the misfortunes and causes of conflict and sickness of Lingkati were also sent with him. Peace and happiness was once again restored in the kingdom of King Gesser of Ling. So this is the story of Changxin Gelpo. And now, what is actually interesting to note is, this is the story, and when you look at the content of the ritual, is that it is exactly the same, Gelpo Chuni, the expulsion of the gap or the malignant spirit. The content of this ritual and this story is exactly the same. The only difference is that this is a narrative form, whereas in the ritual, it is explained in a very, very poetic form. So now let me briefly talk about the ritual. In this ritual, what actually happened, it is a very simple ritual, which does not require much preparation. We just need Junagu, 9 types of cereal, and small quantity, and they cut this changmashi, the small branches of changmashi, and one part, and they make a bundle of changmashi, and one part of it is painted into black, which represents the malignant spirit, and the other part is kept white, representing the ultimate consequence of performing this ritual, that is happiness and goodness. Now, an effigy of Changxin Gelpo is prepared, and a butter lamp is lit, and then a po or a medium performs this ritual. And during the course of the ritual, King Gesser of Ling is invited and invoked. After invocation, the Changxin Gelpo is slowly chased away. And before chasing away Changxin Gelpo, the poor or the medium narrates this story in a poetic form. And slowly steadily, Changxin Gelpo is scheduled to leave the house, starting right from the rooftop. Rooftop is identified as the residence of the flag deity and the attic to store the straw for the cattle in winter. And then the corner of the house is identified as a place for the mother, and the center of the house as playground of children. So slowly, this malignant spirit death is chased away. So after chasing away this malignant spirit or gap, people have the feeling that they would bring prosperity and happiness back in the community. So this is a ritual. And we also have, this is not the only one. Of course, I have not done a very detailed study, but from what I understand is that there is a ritual called Karfu, and in that one also, when you study the content of this ritual, Karfu of Tamang village, we come to understand that here there is the same thing happening. The content of the ritual actually is a story where people actually invite God to come down, and a bat goes to heaven to invite the God down on earth. And similarly, Thabe ritual in Ondu Padang region. Here we have 13 invocations of the God. And in this 13 invocation, what we actually notice is that this